stay tuned for Naturalistic Support coming up. It's 2 p.m. and this is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online.
Ooh, child, things are gonna get easier. Ooh, child, things will get brighter. Ooh, child, things are gonna get easier. How things will get brighter.
Someday, yeah, we'll put it together and we'll get it undone. Someday when the world is much brighter.
Good afternoon, and welcome back to Naturalistic Support. I'm Arnell Doré, and joining me today is Elaine Durbach. Hi, Elaine.
Hi, Arnell. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you back. Naturalistic Support is a new approach to lasting personal growth and healthier, more satisfying relationships. We combine a progressive understanding of our human experience with peer support on this program, and by doing so, we help each other. And this happens when you call us to talk about yourselves as well as to talk to each other. Our number is 212-209-2877. And today, we'll be looking at, again, how a naturalistic humanist perspective changes the way we approach criminal justice. So we got into this topic a bit last week, and there's still more to chew over, so we're going to do that. But before we get into our topic, last week a couple of listeners asked us some questions that I wanted to address and answer. First, one listener asked for Elaine's book info, because Elaine is an author, a three-time author, right, Elaine?
Well, three fiction books that are published, and a few others that we won't talk about now.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah. So Elaine, where can people find your books?
Well, my three novels that are in a series: Roundabout, Laugh, Life After Felix, and Next Steps are available from bookstore.com or from Amazon.
Bookstore.com or Amazon?
Yep. At least the first two are on bookstore.com. I need to check up on the third.
And
all three are available.
And again, those titles a little louder?
Sure. Roundabout, Laugh, L-A-F, Life After Felix, and number three, Next Steps. They're all a saga of Sally Paddington and her recovery from losing the love of her life.
Okay, well, that is what listeners have wanted to know. Also, I was asked last week for the name of the song we played during the halfway break, but I had a memory lapse. So now let me tell you, because we're going to play it again today. It's There But For Fortune by Phil Oakes. Yes, and it was sang by Joan Baez. So yeah, very, very beautiful. So, how does a naturalistic humanist perspective change the way we approach criminal justice? Well, part of it is when we look at human behavior through a naturalistic lens, we recognize that all of our behaviors are the inexorable result of everything that has led up to that given moment. And that includes behaviors that society loves and praises and rewards, as well as behaviors that society condemns and is understandably threatened by. But if we're unlucky enough to behave in ways that society is threatened by, in ways that harms others, That's a matter of luck. And we need to recognize that, but for that person's luck, could be you or could be me. And we need to have a lot more humility and empathy and kindness, even when we're dealing with people who seem to lack empathy and humility and kindness, because everybody is entitled to have their humanity respected, and people who can't respect and respond to other people's humanity do not deserve to be treated in that same pathological way. So last week we talked about that rationale for not treating people badly, but at the same time wanting to protect society and to keep people safe. Well, it turns out that you don't have to sacrifice one for the other. There are a lot of good alternatives that are less harmful to the people who have to have their freedom limited in order to ensure everyone's safety, but also those same methods that are less harmful to the people involved are also much better at protecting society. And we spoke last week about a couple of them. We talked about there's programs in some prisons where there's dog training, which is very rehabilitative and very helpful, and lots of prisoners would love to be involved in something like that, but unfortunately that's a very limited program. We spoke about a much more humane prison system in Norway, which is kind of a world-class system that the whole world looks at and relishes, because their recidivism rate went down from like 65% to 70% down to like more like 20%. And we have in America a 65% to 70% recidivism rate right now, which is an indicator that we are failing. And so let's go back to where we left off on some of the alternatives. We were, I think, last talking about an alternative called restorative justice. Elaine, maybe you can pick up where we say one alternative restorative justice seeks to repair harm in both the person that was harmed and in the person who did the harm.
Okay. I've been scrolling through these points that we were covering.
Yeah.
And revisiting. Okay, here we go. Yeah. So the restorative justice seeks to repair harm in both the person who was harmed and the person who did harm. That's a very different... Oh, I'm so sorry. So sorry.
Yeah. No, it's okay.
My phone was supposed to be off. Okay. Being concerned with the progress of the person doing the harm, restorative justice also helps to protect the community from further harm down the line. You know, if that person who's committing harm returns to society and then gets jailed again, you've achieved very little.
Yeah, and you know, unfortunately, prison often makes people with problems have much worse problems, and ultimately, most prisoners ultimately do wind up being released somewhere down the line, and then society has got a bigger problem to deal with.
Yeah, you know what? One of the statistics that horrifies me is when you see the cost of jailing somebody, you think what that same money could do as a salary, as a wage.
Yeah.
For that person to be able to earn a living.
Yeah.
And so many of the crimes that people are locked up for are about hardship, about lack of you know, gainful
resources,
employment.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so the restorative justice approach offers empathy to the people harmed, but it also has empathy for the offender, recognizing that their behavior is highly likely to be connected to the harm that was done to them. The restorative justice process provides an opportunity for the person who has done harm, to begin to recognize the impact of their actions and to engage in a process of attempting to compensate the person harmed in whatever way possible. The mechanics of the process can involve a meeting or a series of meetings between the person harmed and the offender, but only if all the parties agree. The community members are also involved to provide support and facilitate the process. Additionally, a related approach to dealing with people who have harmed others is transformative justice, seeking not only the restoration of the victim to whatever extent is possible, but also seeking to transform the life of the person who has been harmed. I'm a little confused about this.
The person who's been harmed
is also the victim.
The person, okay. Right. So it's not only looking to transform the life, to restore the victim, but to transform the life of the person who's
so
been
that
harmed.
So they also have kind of a growth opportunity.
Exactly.
Wow.
Exactly. Yeah. To turn the tragedy into something that you grow from and gain from. So not only the person's been harmed to transform their life, but the person who's done the harm and the community.
That's extraordinary. I mean, and it takes pretty extraordinary people, I should imagine, to work within that system.
Yeah, it does take a different kind of person than your average prison guard, right?
Yeah.
So it does take people who have skill. But, you know, there are a lot of people out there who are naturally empathetic and sharp and sensitive to the things that such a facilitator would have to be sensitive to. I don't think you really need a super, you know, professional hierarchy to implement something like this. I think it can be implemented on the community level.
And then there's this point that you make that the system also requires a transformation, or it aims for a transformation of the social conditions that perpetuate violence. The systems of oppression and exploitation and domination and state violence.
Yep, absolutely. And because if you want to really get at the cause of the harm and the cause of the violence, generally there are all these social dynamics that we need to fix, that we can improve, and if we do, we're going to have less of the behaviors that we don't want.
Yeah. So you mentioned an organization called Creative Interventions.
Yep. They call it a toolkit, but it's essentially an online book, and it's available for free. If you Google Creative Interventions toolkit, you'll probably come across their website, and the resources they have are excellent. And you know what those resources do is they show what's possible. They show, like, if you're approaching this with new eyes and a creative mindset, you can re-envision how we address these problems.
That's just extraordinary. And as you were saying, it's not as if you're denying the need for some people to be held in a form of custody if they pose too great a risk of harming others.
If we cannot trust someone to not do further harm to another, then clearly we have to limit their liberty. We have to limit their freedom. But it doesn't have to be this inhumane, intolerable conditions that we subject people to.
Yeah. I was thinking of a situation here in New Jersey, the Delaney Detention Center, where they're holding people picked up by ICE for supposedly violating our immigration laws. These people are now held in a situation with brutal conditions, bad food, bad heating and cooling. I mean, horrendous circumstances, and of course they can't earn a living for their family.
Yeah.
So the family's put in financial pressure, and if there are, especially if there are young adults in that family, their need to get some kind of income goes up. So
sure.
The likelihood of further, of possible crime is increased by their hardship.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not even a question, often it's not even a question of, well, they can't get food, they can't get clothing, they can't get housing. Sometimes people do have those things, but just the marginalized place that people wind up feeling that they've been relegated to in our society does great psychological damage.
Yeah. Yeah.
While deprivation is a relative experience. So there's this idea of relative deprivation. So, you know, people say, you know, poor people, they have big screen TVs and cell phones and, what are they belly aching about? But, you know, everything is relative. People who are marginalized today do not compare themselves to slaves in 1820. They do not compare themselves to people who were poor in 1500. They compare themselves to the people around them and the wealth and the flagrant display of wealth everywhere. And that creates this relative deprivation, which is psychologically corrosive.
I can only imagine in the way we live, the kind of high density way we live, compared to the way people with very low incomes lived in the past, where there were still survival options that are not available for people living in apartments.
Yep. No, that's absolutely true. Again, you know, if we're going to re-envision our criminal justice system, there are a lot of good arguments for this, and they can be found in a variety of books, essays, lectures, podcasts, and videos, all up and down the internet. As we said, a restorative or transformative justice approach doesn't eliminate the need for some individuals to be held in some form of custody. Inevitably, there will be individuals who pose too great a risk of harming others not to limit their freedom. But other criminal justice systems, like Norway's system, demonstrates there's no reason it needs to be cruel and damaging. Now, the underlying naturalistic humanist philosophy about what results in our being who we are, in our being lucky enough to be the kind of person society rewards or unlucky enough to come into conflict with society, this is a matter of luck of the draw. And I'd like to play a couple clips that actually go into this a little bit more. Like, let's start with Sam Harris. We've played some of these clips before on the show, but they can't be listened to enough. Sam Harris talking, I think, on an interview with Joe Rogan on Joe Rogan's podcast, a little bit about this myth of free will that we all labor, that most of us labor under.
So taking the red pill on free will makes you much more forgiving of a lot of the stuff.
Yes.
Because you see, just everyone is an open system. No one authored themselves. No
right.
one created themselves. No one can directly regulate the effect that, of every influence that they had or didn't have. You know, it's like you are the totality of what brought you here. I mean, the universe has sort of just pushed you to this point in time, and the only thing you've got is your brain and its states, and that is based on your genes and the totality of environmental influences you as a system have had working on you up until this moment. And so the next words that come out of your mouth are part of that process. Now, some people find this to be a demoralizing picture, right? They think, well, okay, well, you're telling me I'm just a robot. But you're a robot that is open, continuously open to influence of, you know, kind of internally based on its own processes. I mean, there's top-down control of, you know, executive function in the brain to your, you know, your emotional life, say, and you're continually open to the influences of culture, right? You know, the culture is this operating system that you're interacting with in each moment, and whatever's getting in can change you in radical ways very quickly. I mean, there's no telling how much you can change on the basis of one new idea coming your way, right? Now, I would argue that that process of change, I mean, if I say something that changes your view on anything, that's not evidence of free will. That is evidence of just yet more causality. I mean, you don't pick the changes that come your way. If I get you to see something that you didn't see a moment before, you're not responsible for the fact that you didn't see it a moment before, and you're not responsible for the fact that you now see it. It's just like the dominoes just kept falling, right?
Right.
But it does give you this a far more patient sense.
Yeah, and that's what we're trying to say, that ultimately we wind up being a lot more understanding of how this is a matter of luck, who we wind up being. Well, listeners, what do you think about the way we currently practice criminal justice in our society? How should a naturalistic, humanistic understanding of what drives us to behave as we do, how should that affect things or transform things? Do you think things are the way they should be? Do you think they should change? How do you think they should change? Have you been involved in the criminal justice system personally at all? Or what about someone in your family or extended family or your neighborhood? Give us a call at 212-209-2877. Elaine?
Yeah, I think it's an extraordinary idea, and I'm realizing in myself that some of my thinking revolves around blame, revenge, a desire to see the people that I think are doing harm made other. They are other. They deserve to be restricted, to be punished.
Mm.
And when you put it in these terms, that everybody is the sum total of influences, it really stretches one's moral boundaries to accept that, to let go of blame. I think there's something very tempting and seductive about othering and blaming. You know, they are bad. They are stupid. They are mean. They are a danger.
Yeah, well, they're certainly at the core of what's tearing our society apart right now.
Exactly.
Blame injures us. It injures us on a personal, interpersonal level, and it's injuring us as a society. And I want to play a second clip from that same podcast of Sam Harris talking to Joe Rogan, because he expounds a little bit on the whole factor of luck, and even in regard to the dynamic of criminal justice. So I think this is worth listening to.
The moment we really understand human evil at the level of the brain, the moment we understand psychopathy, say, which is, I mean, maybe that's not the totality of evil, but that's, you know, certainly center of the bullseye. Once we understand psychopathy as a neurological condition that's governed by genes and environment, and we can actually intrude at the level of the brain to mitigate it. So like psychopathy becomes a disease, right? It becomes an injuries syndrome, right, that we can fix. And let's say it's a very simple fix. Let's say it's a pill, right? Let's say it's just a neurotransmitter imbalance. In the presence of that breakthrough, we will feel very differently about that species of human evil. We will not judge it in the same way. Because what will happen is you'll give people the pill, and they'll say, I can't believe I was that dangerous. Like a thank you. Like I'm as horrified by who I was before you cured me as you were, right? And psychopathy in the presence of a cure for it would look much more like diabetes than it looks like evil in the present case. And people aren't imagining what it would be like to be there, what it would be like to actually fully understand the underlying neurophysiology here and actually have something. I mean, there's no guarantee we'll be able to deal with it in a simple way, but it's certainly possible. The classic example is just, you know, like the Charles Whitman example, where, you know, you have a brain tumor that's causing this aberrant behavior. In that case, everyone sees, okay, this is not evil. This is a brain tumor.
That's the tower shooter guy?
Yeah, back in 64, I think. In the same way that a brain tumor is exculpatory there, I think a full understanding of the underlying neurology would be exculpatory. Again, it doesn't mean you, in the meantime, before we get there, we obviously have to lock up dangerous people if there's no way to help them. But the more we see the causes, the more we view this in terms of just sheer bad luck, right? Like there are people who, when they're adults, are quintessentially evil, who provoke the greatest feeling of vengeance from us. But if you just walk back their timeline, you recognize that at a certain, you know, they were 4 years old at one point, right? They were the 4-year-old who was destined to become this terrible person.
Right.
It's an unlucky 4-year-old.
Right.
You know, and so at what point, where's the bright line that says, okay, here's the point where it's appropriate to just hate this person and feel no compassion. And it, on the other side of this line, you should just feel compassion because this person's unlucky. There is no such line. And a complete understanding of this lifeline in scientific terms would obliterate any line you think you have, right? It would just be this cascade of causation. And, you know, adding randomness to the picture doesn't help, right? Randomness is just, you know, somebody's in your brain rolling dice and influencing your behavior that way. Well, that doesn't give you the free will people think they have. So ironically, what seems deflationary of the gravitas of the human spirit for people opens the door to, at least in my view, a far more ethical and tolerant and patient and understanding view of human failings and human frailty. And then at that point, you can just have a conversation about what's pragmatic, what works, what helps people change. Like, in this person over here who's doing terrible things, is there something we can do to make him a better person? Well, if there is, let's do that without all the judgment.
And what works is one of the big questions, right? So two considerations are, what is ethical, what is fair and reasonable, and also what's effective at keeping us safe?
I'm thinking about how we feel about ourselves too. I mean, from the point of view of the harm doer, if we've done harm, if we're doing something corrupt or harmful, and we're presented with this point of view, this kind of understanding, this charitable view, given the chance to change our behavior and not be condemned, not be punished, so long as we commit to trying to do better.
I think that part of what makes growing and becoming a healthier person so difficult is kind of collapsing under the weight of all that guilt and self-blame and self-judgment. You know, people think, I am evil, I am bad, I should be ashamed. And I think it's very rare that those thoughts result in a healthier, more functional person that society would want them to be. I think that those kind of thoughts probably, just far more often results in perpetuating an understanding of oneself that's toxic.
Yeah, that you... you feel that pain is the appropriate state for somebody as horrible as you to be in.
Yep.
Yeah.
So listeners, we are 212-209-2877. We're going to take our halfway break, and on the other side, we are looking to hear from you.
You're listening to Naturalistic Support right here on 99.5 FM WBAI New York.
Non-commercial, listener-sponsored.
Peace and Justice Radio.
On Wednesdays from 2 to 3, Naturalistic Support is taking listener calls, offering a revolutionary new way to think about ourselves and reach out to each other.
I just wanted to call in to give encouragement to the last caller.
It hit right on where I am right at this moment.
You really hit the proverbial nail on the head.
I really connected with what you were saying about loneliness.
We are hardwired to help each other.
Getting past the blame, owning your own truth, letting go of judgmental thoughts.
I felt so fortunate to hear this.
You went through every single one of the things that I've been working on with my life. Now, you said all that, I'm like, holy cow, what is this guy talking? Is he talking to me right now?
The Naturalistic Revolution is a game changer. Listen to us break it down on Wednesdays from 2 to 3.
I want to thank you so much. You helped me so much.
That was There But For Fortune by Phil Oakes. Great song, sung by Joan Baez. And we're back. This is Naturalistic Support, where we today are talking about naturalistic humanism and criminal justice and how being a naturalistic humanist affects the way we think about this. Elaine, we have a couple callers on the line, so let's get to that.
Great.
Yep.
Can I welcome them?
Yeah, please.
This is WBAI. You're on the air. Who's calling and where are you calling from?
Hello, caller. Hello.
No, if you are. Yes, I'm here.
Okay, good.
Hi. Can you tell us your name?
My name is Francis, and I'm in Fishkill, New York.
Hey, Francis.
And it's an interesting topic, what happens to people and what they do when they do bad things and what, where's the motivation? And very interestingly, I got a book in front of me that I just finished reading, and it's called The Science of Revenge. Have you all heard of that?
No.
It sounds fascinating.
It's by a scientist from Yale University, where they're doing research on brain waves of, you know, really genuine science, where they're looking at how different parts of the brain is activated.
Yeah, neuroscience or with functional magnetic resonance imaging.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And what they're finding out is that people that are doing drugs like cocaine and stuff like that, they have a particular brain pattern, and people that are harboring resentment, which I was harboring resentment, of course, I grew up in a dysfunctional family, and so that resentment has the same brain waves as the people that are taking these hard drugs. And so there's a, so the motivation to satisfy that craving is essentially, they're saying, is the same for people that are harboring resentment. And they're looking for some place to take that resentment out on some place, somebody, not necessarily the people that caused them the harm in the first place.
Yeah.
Very interesting, Francis.
That's fascinating. Do you know who the book is by, Francis?
Oh, yeah, it's by James Kimmel.
James Kimmel.
He's a lawyer, but he's got a very interesting story why he actually got involved with this type of work. He actually was in a situation where he wanted to kill some people that killed his dog. Here's the takeaway. The solution that they talk about, in fact, he's been interviewed by Dr. Phil several times in the last month or two. The solution is to deal with forgiveness.
Yeah.
And so my experience with this is, my parents spoke Polish, and they could read, write Polish. They also read, write English. And when I was a little kid, you know, we would be sitting at the table and would be having maybe a conversation of some kind. And next thing you know, they're starting to talk Polish. Well, I didn't understand a word they're saying because they never taught us. And so for me, you know, I said, well, wait a minute. And now I'm 78 years old now, right? So I'm thinking to myself, you know, there was a certain amount of where I should have been able to have normal communications with my parents and not all of a sudden have the rug pulled out from under me. Now, how does that affect me? Well, I took both Latin and German in high school, and I flunked them all. And I'm trying to learn Spanish now, the Lord's Prayer in Spanish, and I'm having trouble. Why? Because I have an anger towards that actually resulted from that early childhood experience. Mm. So what I'm doing is I'm working on a forgiveness, because I say, hey, you know, this wasn't fair. I should not have, as a little kid, had to put up with that kind of stuff. And I think what we're missing is that this whole idea of forgiveness, it goes all the way back to the Lord's Prayer, where it says, forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. Well, who's the debtor in this case? Well, my parents were the debtors. And my obligation at this point, because I'm also in a 12-step program.
Yeah.
And so forgiving one's debtors is a primary important way. And I'm also finding out that since I'm doing this, I'm experiencing more freedom.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Francis, I think what you're pointing out is, you know, when we forgive others, it's not just about the others, it's about ourselves. It's really letting go of something toxic that's harmful to us.
Yeah, I love that. I love the fact that you feel that extra freedom. That, yeah.
Yeah. No, it's,
resentment is the poison you take in order to.
Yeah, and expect that your enemy is going to die. You drink the poison. And expect that that the other guy's going to die. It doesn't work that way. Francis, thank you for your call. We've got another call on the line, but thank you, and call us again.
I appreciate your interest in this topic, because I know too many people that will benefit from being able to forgive, and that is really
good. Yep. Thank you, my friend.
And it's
appreciate
never
it.
Too late. Yep. Never
Bye.
Too late.
Okay. This is WBAI. You're on the air. Who's calling and where are you calling from?
Hi, this is Steve, Beverly Hills.
Hey, Steve. Wow. long way.
Just laughing. I love your show because it's theory. It's really theory as opposed to practice. I mean, communism looks good in theory, if you were talking communism. But agency versus luck. I would say there's agency to a good deal. And those who are depending upon luck, well, maybe there are different species. Well, no, there were 1,000 arrests of bus people. You know what I'm talking about? Immigrants, so-called, in New York City in 1 month alone. 1,000. You think they need population control? Listen, I'd like to hear you guys do a debate for charity with either Sean Hannity on WOR or any one of the conservatives on WABC AM radio. Would you do it for charity? Just think about it. And thank you so much, and God bless. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Thank you for the call, Steve.
I think that we go a long way beyond theory. Those recidivism rates are financial, practical. They are concrete results, not pure theory.
Yeah, and, you know, I also think that it's easy to to look at the people who are desperately looking to contribute to our society and help themselves in the process, otherwise known as undocumented immigrants, and to be cruel and to say the kind of unkind things that Steve seemed to be saying there, which is, it's sad. It saddens me to hear it, particularly on our program, because we don't support that kind of thinking.
You've made it very clear that you're not exempting people who do harm.
No, of course, and I think you're right, Elaine. That clearly we're talking about. Clearly we're talking about not just theory. We're talking about a practical approach to saving our society from undue harm that we're causing ourselves because we're dealing with things with vengeance, because we're dealing with things through this retributive lens. And
it seems to be feeding into that notion that these kind of airy-headed woke people are welcoming criminals and mad people in and giving them the vote and handing them three-bedroom houses. Not what the truth is about.
Yeah, absolutely. We have another call on the line. Elaine, why don't you take this one?
Sure. This is WBAI. You're on the air. Who's calling and where are you calling from?
Hello, my name is Billy. I'm calling from East Orange, New Jersey.
Oh, hi, Billy. I'm just up the street from you.
Okay, one main point, which I just hope you accept and you should realize. Significant change comes about when there are organized political movements, civil rights movement, 8 hours a day, workers' rights, etc. I wish you would, in the course whole hour, mentioned something like October 18th, No King's Day, protest against Trump.
The other good point.
The other thing that just really kind of bothers me is the concept that we should put a lot of analytical power into the notion of luck. Quick look at the distribution of the commission of petty crimes and medium-sized crimes have to do with economic and racial profiles. Luck may be way down on the list. And the other thing is using the concept of society. We have a highly unequal society in terms of power and money and politicians who are purchased by corporate thugs. So we have a society, but a particular kind. With respect to Norway, really interesting ideas on prison reform. They're basically a homogeneous social democratic society with significant social programs and social safety nets. So please think about getting away from the concept of luck and just referencing, well, society's norms.
Billy, I just want to respond to you on a couple things you're saying. First of all, society, Norwegian society, didn't always have a social safety net, and they didn't always have a kind and humanistic prison system. You know, just like we don't have one yet, but we could have one. And I'll admit that it's certainly more of a challenge here when we're a heterogeneous society, and it is.
Movement.
Yeah.
Can we afford different parts?
Say that again.
Social. Norway after post-World War II, have had social democratic / socialist policies, more than just two. We need organized political movement, because if you look at history, civil rights, workers' rights, women's rights, that's how significant. Listen, restorative justice is cool. The amount of human resources required ain't going to happen in our country without well-organized political movement.
Yeah, Billy, but part of getting a well-organized political movement is changing the narrative, because right now we have a narrative that really blames people for how they wind up. And I agree with you that we can analyze the problem in terms of social analytics is certainly applicable. But what I'm saying about luck is whether you wind up in one of those groups that is highly marginalized, or you wind up in a group that is extremely lucky in terms of where they wind up on the hierarchy, that is a matter of luck. That is not chosen.
Different classes with economic strata reproduce themselves over time. Yes, few escape and so forth.
Right, but which group you wind up in is a matter of luck. I'm not trying to diminish diminish the social political dynamic that results in different hierarchies. But what I'm saying is we don't choose our genetic determinants. We don't choose our environmental determinants. These things happen to us.
Parents who gave birth to us, because they're in the same income class and racial class as their parents, as were their parents. I think luck is really a weak concept in a socially stratified, capitalist, racist, patriarchal society.
Yeah, I hear you, Billy. Billy, we got to take another caller, but thank you for your call. Call us again. And go ahead, Elaine. Elaine? Oh, we might have lost Elaine. Okay, this is WBAI. You're on the air. Hello, who's calling?
Hello.
Yeah, who's calling? Where are you calling from?
This is Elle from Long Island. I have to say that the quality of the previous caller, I could not hear him clearly.
I know.
I just want to make sure that I am addressing at least the issue that you have brought up.
Yeah.
I heard your first, one of your callers state of those who take drugs, that their brain waves are similar to those who hold grudges against people.
Those who seek revenge, yeah.
Okay, and I'm saying now that in Gaza, in other parts of the world, but especially in Gaza, because that is all the news that we hear, where we see that they want to say 68,000, I say 100, between 100 and 125,000 would be more appropriate for the loss of life, being men, women, and children. And if a country, its people, is pushed to just about the end, genocide completely out, they have no way of basically competing with the world because the youth, they're precious.
So, just in terms of revenge, what were you saying?
I'm saying that as far as revenge is concerned,
yeah.
As far as let's sit down and have a kumbaya moment, I don't think that you can basically have such a moment. And you can't determine if a person is going to be vengeful or not, because I'm sure the people in Palestine, that their loss of entire families is not something that they will sit down and say.
Right, right. Look, what we're clearly talking about is there's a cycle of harm and then vengeance for that harm and then vengeance for that vengeance. You know, when we're looking at an ongoing tragedy like the one unfolding in the Middle East, you know, we're talking about a complex series of actions and reactions and actions before that. And you could infinitely regress and say this horrible act of violence was the result of this previous horrible act of violence from the other side, which was the result of this horrible act of violence from the other side. You know, the only way to go forward is to say, as long as we hold vengeance in our hearts, we are going to only see more bloodshed. And I think that's true for our society as well. It's true for war, it's true for oppression, and it's true for this criminal justice system that we are not being protected by. And
yeah, I take this to what you just said, and I'll be brief. Bottom line is, when you have a situation where those who are in essence creating a horrific deed, producing that deed on a people that can't possibly retaliate in any form or fashion, to tell them that, okay, now this is take the pain out of your heart and let's sit down and try to get it together, I think that if you're going to take that position, then the people who have planned, who have created, right now, Palestine, it's nothing.
Al, we're not talking about Palestine. We are talking about the mindset that results in us harming people the way we do in our criminal justice system. I thank you for your call, but clearly all you want to talk about is Palestine, and we really can't go there. That's an entire 20 shows in itself. Very complex topic. But do call us again when you're ready to address the actual topic that we're talking about. But, you know, Elaine, are you there with us, Elaine?
Yes.
Oh, good, good, good. Yeah, I mean, you know, what we're talking about is, you know, this mindset of vengeance. Yeah. Things are not going to get better for the way our society functions here, and it's certainly not going to get better in a place like the Middle East unless people can get past the vengeance, because this very reaction that Elle was complaining about is the result of it's clearly the result of this feeling aggrieved and wanting vengeance and, you know, wanting more vengeance from the other side, encouraging that or saying that that's, you know, it is understandable, but it's not sufficient to solve the problem. It's only sufficient to keep the problem escalating.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we are out of time, believe it or not.
There's so much more to talk about.
I know. There is so much more to talk about, but we actually do have to go. Again, if you could give us support, listeners, by going to buddy.wbai.org and picking Naturalistic Support and making a small monthly donation, we so would appreciate it. You've been listening to Naturalistic Support's look at criminal justice. Let's lower this a little bit. And I'm Arnel Doray, and today we're joined by Elaine Durbach. Thanks, Elaine.
Oh, my pleasure.
And thanks to our talented engineer, Red Johnson, and to Hilla Weiss for her support. Tune in again next Wednesday at 2 p.m. for another edition of Naturalistic Support. And natural archived editions can be found at our website at WBAI.org and at EqualTimeForFreeThought.org. Hi to my foster mom, Marilyn, and stay where you are, because coming right up is the Katie Halper Show. And remember, always try to be kind, because you never really know what someone else is going through.
He ain't heavy. He's my brother. So on we go. His welfare is my concern. No burden is he to bear. We'll get there. For I know he would not encumber me. He ain't heavy. My brother.